Sort of transitional point in the course. We're on the home stretch, very nearly done, and it's kind of getting towards the time where I can sort of take a bit more liberties with the sort of things I cover. So today's lecture, I won't be taking liberties today. I'll just be doing sort of continuing on this theme and thought about extra dimensions. But I want to just wrap up a couple of thoughts that we had yesterday, and then talk about warped extra dimensions, which are a little bit more of a modern perspective on Kaluza-Klein theory. So, as I was saying, Kaluza-Klein theory is actually quite an old idea. It was from 1920-ish, and so sort of initially it was probably like Dirac's monopole, more just of a curiosity, and people maybe just thought, yes, all very well, but. Whereas as we kind of started to become more sort of, I guess, open-minded about how many dimensions there were and started just exploring physics more generically, this led us to think about what might happen with extra dimensions. And then the natural thing to do was to use Kaluza and Klein's idea. But I think I flagged this when I was deriving the four-dimensional action or the five-dimensional Einstein action, that I explicitly kept in a G5 and showed that G4 depended on G5 and the internal length. So this was something that, you know, is definitely something that's this century and not last, in the sense that people used to imagine that the extra dimensions were curled up at the Planck scale. So that's kind of what we're going to just explore a little bit today. And I'll be doing it most of the time in the context of explicit toy models so that you can sort of see concrete implementations. But these all illustrate particular features that are used in more complicated compactifications. So the general theme of today is going to be called warped extra dimensions, so we'll see what that means. But before I start, I'd just like to, as I say, finish off some thoughts. The simplest way, basically what warping extra dimensions means is that we have space or geometry depending on the extra dimensions. They're not necessarily killing vectors. But before doing that, I just want to, I made a comment about Kaluza-Klein theory, the fact that we did it explicitly for one extra dimension, but of course you could have an arbitrary number of extra dimensions. And if you have more than one, then you have the idea that maybe the internal geometry has symmetries of its own. So for example, the two-sphere. The two-sphere has an SO3 symmetry. So what happens if you compactify on a manifold with some internal symmetry? So you may have a set of killing vectors, so they're labeled by some index. And this index on the killing vector is something that is non-zero on the internal manifold.
What is that symbol?
Sorry?
What is that symbol?
The zero?
No, The upper one, yeah.
M.
M, okay.
Sorry. Perhaps I shouldn't have put the arrow so close. So, for example, I could imagine an internal two-sphere and then my, rather than having, remember we had our d psi plus a mu dx mu squared, that was what we had in 5D. This then goes to, in general, we replace the ym are coordinates on the internal manifold and in our case if we were compactifying on a two sphere they would just be theta and phi and then we have three gauge fields ai that now are a non-abelian gauge field because the I index is telling you about the SO3 representation. So in Kaluza-Klein theory, from our four-dimensional perspective, we end up with quite a lot of fields. We have, the sort of overall a scale factor telling us about the size of the internal dimensions. We also have potentially non-abelian gauge fields, and these correspond to sort of, these internal Killing vectors, so these internal degrees of freedom, internal symmetries. And then it's possible that our manifold also has other, even in the absence of these Killing vectors, these gauge fields, could even have other degrees, distortions that are nonetheless, from a four-dimensional perspective, they don't have a sort of an internal dependence other than, in this case, our Killing vector has this natural sine phi, cos phi type of dependence. So there's all sorts of different ways in which we can potentially distort our internal manifold. So this gives rise to a number of massless four-dimensional fields. So it's not just the gauge field. So when we did just 5D compactification, we have a single scalar and a single gauge field. Both of which were kind of massless, although the scalar coupled to the trace of energy momentum. So, so that's our more general Kaluza-Klein theory. So that's one thought. I just wanted you to kind of see how Kaluza-Klein theory was not just a sort of simple case of doing, having boosts in one direction. We saw that just for 5D, a boost in the fifth direction looked like electric charge. So it's not just a simple, it's not that simple. So the other thought that I wanted to wrap up on from yesterday was to talk about the black string instability. because I argued that the black string was unstable from an entropic consideration. I used kind of thermodynamics, which is a nice argument. It's very intuitive, very geometric. However, whether or not you believe it depends on how much you think I've convinced you about black hole thermodynamics. Now, you know, I would be perfectly cool if some of you were a little bit skeptical about that, because there are quite a lot of caveats about the whole process. I gave you the Euclidean approach, but you know, you could have calculated the temperature of the black hole by doing field theory on the black hole background and gotten the same result. Nonetheless, it is kind of trying to patch together this notion of quantum field theory and classical gravity. And I think, you know, if you were just a little bit reluctant to completely commit to that at this point, that would be quite reasonable. So I think to truly convince you that this thing is unstable, I just want to sketch the argument that you actually do. And then I think that that will maybe make you feel a little happier about the discussions of black hole thermodynamics. So I know you've seen perturbation theory, because I know in the GR course you had lots of good stuff about gravitational waves, which, because everybody's of course very excited about gravitational waves at the moment. So here I'd like to talk just a little bit about the perturbation theory of the black string, because this will also kind of be related to perturbation theory of black holes, which is of course what you use when you're looking at the sort of final stages after a black hole merger, where the black hole settles down into its new state. So what we've already seen, I'll put a recall here. So we saw this, was it the Palatini lemma, where we see what the variation of the Ricci tensor is in terms of derivatives of the variation of the connection. So the idea about perturbation theory, perturbing around an Einstein manifold, is that you take a little perturbation of your metric, so G goes to G plus H, and then you take your Einstein equations and linearize around the background G. So our background G here is the five-dimensional black string. So I derived for you at the time, and I believe Neil has also done this for you, when we look at how gamma varies, we see that we get three derivatives of H here and one derivative of H here. So this is what we get. And then if we look at this, this index here is kind of contracted on one of the H indices here. And so what we'd like is for there not to be another covariant derivative in between. So we swap the order of covariant differentiation. We know how to do that using the Riemann identity. So that's me having swapped the order of differentiation. Then I've got to add a load of Riemann terms here. So I get four Riemann terms because I've got two for each of these swaps. So this is what I get. So I think you've seen this at some point. And we call this the Lichnerowicz operator. So it's essentially the curved space wave equation. We can see that we've got a D'Alembertian on H. We've got some Riemann curvature. We've got some Ricci curvature. And then we've got the second line. And I think Neil explained that we can take the second line to be zero. We take that derivative to vanish. So this is called the D'Adondo gauge. And it's something that we can always choose whether or not matter is present. If T mu nu and delta T mu nu are zero, we can also take vanishing trace. So this is really just about dealing with the problem of gauge and general relativity, which is something that often tends to plague you when you're doing real problems. So once we've chosen this gauge, we still have gauge freedom. We can still make a gauge transformation as long as it preserves that D'Adondo gauge. And it turns out that if you put in a gauge transformation preserving the D'Adondo gauge means you've got box wave operator plus Ricci times your infinitesimal gauge transformation has to vanish. So that's, again, that's like the curved space vector wave equation. So what that means is that we start off with d into d plus 1 over 2 degrees of freedom, in other words, non-zero components of H. We subtract the gauge constraints, and then finally what's left we have d gauge degrees of freedom which means that our physical graviton has d into d plus 1 on 2 minus 2d, which is d into d minus 3 over 2 degrees of freedom. So in four dimensions, that's 2 degrees of freedom, and we associate that with the polarization states of the gravitational wave. So you probably saw this in terms of the cross, so the plus and the cross. So it's a quadrupole effect. You have a sort of alternating distortion, and they either line up with your axes or 45 degrees. So that's sort of all familiar. But what I want to do is to apply it to this black string. So that's my background metric. So if we're finding our sort of general perturbation is obviously potentially going to look quite messy, but we have a lot of symmetry in our background metric. So the first thing is that because the entropy argument was simply sort of thinking about areas, it only sort of talked about the overall radius and something, you know, some notion of what was happening in the extra direction z. It didn't really depend on any theta or phi distortion. So we're going to guess that our instability is spherically symmetric. Now, in general, for any perturbation in a spherically symmetric background, you would decompose with respect to angular momentum. Now, you know, you're all very familiar with scalar angular momentum eigenfunctions, but, you know, here we've got a tensor, which is means that, you know, our angular momentum eigenfunctions are actually quite involved. So this is an enormous simplification. Because what it means is that we have no cross terms between our angles and any other index. It also means that the perturbation in the theta phi directions is just simply something that makes our sphere either grow or shrink. So that's what that information is saying. And then we use this notion that dt and dz are killing vectors to say that we can decompose with respect, we can Fourier analyze our problem essentially. So we can take e to the I mu z and e to the I omega t and say we're going to do separation of variables. So in other words, our notion is that our H is some, we split it up into eigenfunctions in the t and z directions. So this is a sort of fairly standard argument when you want to solve to solve a problem in a background that has a lot of symmetry. So what, this is what we do. We find that HZZ satisfies a scalar wave equation. And since that's easy to write down, I'll write it down. So I simply want to write it down so you can see the broad structure that, you get from this. So in this case, my d by dt squared in the D'Alembertian has given me, I'm saying here that I'm, for an instability, I'm actually looking for a complex or indeed imaginary omega, imaginary frequency. So this thing is I omega, I little omega. So here what you kind of see is these are the terms in the wave operator coming from d by dz squared and d by dt squared. So we have two kind of eigenvalues here. And you see that the curved space comes in by having these gm on r pieces in the radial part of this wave equation. And so you would look for, if you had an instability in this mode, you would look for a non-trivial solution to this equation. The problem is, if you actually look at it, as you go to infinity, these all of these GM on R pieces kind of cancel out. And what you see is you just end up with H double primed minus mu squared H. So as R goes to infinity, H decays exponentially. Actually, sorry, there's an R there, so it's... So you have H decaying as you go to infinity, and then when you look as R goes to zero, sorry, as R goes to 2GM, you can kind of see you've got R minus 2GM H double primed, constant factor times H, and then H over 2GM. I'll just put it here, it's easier. So as R goes to 2GM, you see that H is also tending to zero. And so this is a sort of quite a common feature if you want to either argue existence or non-existence of solutions. In this case, if there was a solution, it would have that was, you know, physically reasonable, so bounded at the horizon, decaying at infinity, it would have to go between these two interpolating behaviors at these critical points of your differential equation. In other words, it would have to have an R naught such that H primed was naught and H double primed was negative if we say H is positive. But the problem with that is this term is completely positive. So this last piece is positive. This is zero because H primed is zero. But then if H double prime were negative, this last term would also be positive. So the whole thing can never be zero. So we end up saying this cannot be. So we then look at the cross terms. And they also have to be zero. And so what we end up seeing is that what remains is this. So all we've got left are our Fourier modes. We're looking for an instability, so we look for an exponential, dependence on time, and we're left with the sort of distortion of the two-sphere, the either grows or shrinks, and the remaining perturbations in the T and R direction. So there we've got four variables. But we've also got our gauge constraints over here. So we can use our gauge constraints to relate. For example, we're looking at vacuum equations, so the trace is zero. So that gives us K in terms of HTT and HTR. And then we look at our gauge constraints, which essentially tell us HRR and HTT in terms of HTR or whatever. So we end up with for a single variable, a second order ODE. So we then, it's similar to the top one. But more, there's a lot more going on. You know, there's a lot of, instead of 1 minus 2 GM on R, we've got more pieces. We've got more pieces in the H prime term is fairly huge. And again, there's more multiplying pieces in H55. But the general structure is that you still have something with mu squared and omega squared in it. You still have a notion of an exponential decay at infinity and some given dependence as you go to the horizon, only this time you don't have such simple functions multiplying H and H double primed, and it's now possible to link the two solutions together, provided omega and mu have some specific dependence. And so you find a solution. And what it looks like is it takes the black string and it makes it sort of undulate. So it gives it a wave type behavior. And you end up finding it in a finite range of mu. So this mu critical is indeed order 1 over GM, which was what I argued from the entropy perspective. So the reason I wanted to give you an outline of that argument is because What I've talked about here, it's only a sketch, there's a lot of fairly grungy algebra involved in terms of, first of all, finding that you see with our Lichnerovich operator, you have the Ricci may be zero, but Riemann is not. You have to go through and find all those individual components. You have to then do the elimination of the different variables using the gauge constraints before you get down to that single ODE that you're looking for the answer in. Nonetheless, what it is everything, absolutely everything in this argument is classical Einstein gravity. There's no H-bar, nothing at all, no quantum stuff here whatsoever. And yet we found a classical instability of this solution to Einstein gravity that we kind of deduced might be there from a thermodynamic argument. And so it's saying that even though thermodynamics seems a little bit sort of odd, it also raises questions in terms of, you know, the final state of the black hole and where information that you throw into the black hole goes. Nonetheless, it's really encoding something, something real and something, some property about the underlying gravity. So it's kind of, this is why I just wanted you to see this, because it's saying that even though thermodynamics seems like it's a little bit of a shady area, it is actually reflecting some genuine properties of the black hole. So now I'd like to take up the theme of the lecture title. And I want to introduce these warped extra dimensions through a simple example, rather like I did with Kaluza-Klein theory. I'm going to take a single extra dimension. I'm going to almost turn Kaluza-Klein on its head. I'm going to show you how you can get something that looks like four-dimensional gravity when you don't have a killing vector in the extra dimension. And indeed, potentially, the extra dimension could be infinite. And the way you get your localized gravity is because the extra dimensions are very strongly curving or warped. So the example I want to consider is that of a domain wall in anti-de Sitter space. So my action I take my Einstein-Hilbert action and I put in a cosmological constant there, which we're imagining is negative, and I'm going to take my Einstein action there. What I'm thinking of is I have, sort of broadly speaking, just as a cartoon, I've got two bulk manifolds, M plus and M minus. With therefore two boundaries. And I'm saying that my sigma, I'm going to identify my two boundaries as a surface sigma. So this is what my setup is. And then when I do my variational principle, I get my bulk Einstein equations plus a boundary term. So when I vary with respect to my boundary metric, this sigma, I'm just allowing this. This is sort of the appropriate action for a pure cosmological constant, just in sigma. So the first term gives me bulk Einstein plus boundary pieces. The second term, varying the second term, gives me a cancellation of the boundary pieces from the first term, and it also gives me the KAB minus KHAB. So we saw that, I think it was lecture 6, when I was varying K root 8. So in this sense, this is actually viewed sigma as a boundary. But as I've sort of commented when I've been talking about these boundaries and brains, I could also view this sigma as kind of a limit of some sort of localized source. So that's just a sort of cartoon of what I mean there. And notice I've flipped the sign of the normal on the left. So here I would say that T was some sort of averaged energy momentum tensor, approximately localized on sigma. So we saw this when we did the wall. So our equations of motion would be that the jump in our extrinsic curvature across this surface is 8 pi g SAB, which is going to be 8 pi g sigma HAB for our case. So this here, although we've done it from a boundary perspective, it gives us something that is known as the Israel equations. So these were derived back in the 60s by Werner Israel, and they're quite useful for, he was doing them in an astrophysical context, looking at sort of sheets of dust. But they keep cropping up in all sorts of different examples. We often want to approximate sources by saying, well, you know, I'm actually not that interested in the internal structure. What I need is what happens as I go from one side to the other. And so this particular formalism crops up quite a lot in various different applications of gravity. So I just thought that you should see it. So in our case, my example that I want to show you, I take anti-de Sitter space where I've used this coordinate. We did this with the wall. This now is a solution in anti-de Sitter space. My normal is d by dz, I'm going to take my boundary to be at z equals 0. My extrinsic curvature is simply the projection of the covariant derivative of the normal on the surface sigma. And that's proportional to the metric on z equals 0. So at z equals 0, my induced metric or intrinsic metric is just eta. For z less than 0, I simply take the mirror image of my space-time and take z goes to minus z on the top, and I get e to the plus 2kz. So in this case, k minus is minus k plus. My normal is still d by dz, but because the dependence of my metric is e to the plus exponential, not minus, I get the opposite sign. So if I now ask, what do my Israel equations give me? My delta k is minus 2k eta mu nu, because it's twice k plus my delta k mu nu. I trace that to get delta k, so then I get minus 8k. So I've got plus 8k eta mu nu, so that's obviously 6k eta mu nu, which is 8 pi g sigma eta mu nu. So this tells me what the tension of my domain wall has to be. So what we've kind of constructed here is a solution that is flat Minkowski space, a flat Minkowski surface embedded in a negative cosmological constant space-time. Now we can take eta goes to some arbitrary Einstein metric, and we still have a solution. We know that from looking at our general expression of the Ricci tensor. When I derived it for the domain wall, we saw that we simply got some extra pieces that depended on the extra dimension and its curvature times the individual Ricci tensor living in this four-dimensional or lower-dimensional space. So what that kind of means is it looks like four-dimensional Einstein gravity is sitting inside this five-dimensional theory. Now, that doesn't really prove that you have four-dimensional gravity sitting there, but if you look at perturbation theory, then you find that gravity is localized at low energy. So I think I've gone through that in past years. So what this particular example is showing is that in this example, we've got one extra dimension. The space, as we move away from our sort of internal brain here, this is our z equals zero. We've got this exponential walk factor. So distances are kind of shrunk. Should really have it going down to there. Our walk factor is very strongly distorting the space as we move away from our four-dimensional brain. So it's absolutely the antithesis of Kaluza-Klein theory. Kaluza-Klein theory had a compact extra dimension, which was a killing vector of the full geometry. Here, potentially, I haven't identified Z, potentially I have an infinite extra dimension, and it's certainly not a killing vector. The geometry depends very strongly on this extra dimension, and yet I'm still getting four-dimensional gravity localized on this surface. So this particular example, toy model, called the Randall-Sundrum model. And it was introduced back in the late 90s simply as an alternative to Kaluza-Klein theory. The reason that Randall and Sundrum were interested in this was essentially going back to this point that I made when we did Kaluza-Klein theory. If I just schematically, write down my Einstein action, if I were to sort of put in, this assumption that it was some warped compactification with some internal G-formu nu depending on x plus some extra manifold depending on y. So here I'm kind of imagining sort of schematically that I can decompose my metric into a sort of dy, d minus 4, which is obviously some non-trivial manifold. I may have a warp factor, simple warp factor sitting outside. I've got a g mu nu dx mu dx nu. This is sort of a schematic type of representation here. If I calculate the Ricci tensor of that manifold, I'm sort of going to end up with, you know, terms involving A and B, but terms that are, you know, specific. I'm going to end up with a term involving this Ricci. There'll be a term involving that Ricci potentially as well. But the whole picture will boil down to a four-dimensional action with some prefactor, volume type of prefactor. And so what I see is that my Newton's constant could potentially have some renormalization. So this is an alternate way between the gravitational interaction and the standard model. So it's saying that when we're trying to calculate our sort of low energy field theory, we don't just focus on trying to find the right gauge group. We can also be quite inventive about what internal manifolds we take. And part of that compactification process gives you this extra factor in the Newton's constant. And so it's a way to weaken gravity, in essence. So just to wrap up my last 2 minutes. One thing I've kind of avoided mentioning so far is that if I want to get a significant hierarchy for the gravitational interaction, I'm going to have to make my internal volume significant, not from a sort of gravitational perspective, but from a particle physics perspective. And so why would gravity see the extra dimensions and not particle physics? So I'm just going to give a very brief toy model to motivate this. Remember, we had our domain wall. With our profile, Tansch profile. And what I want to do is to couple a fermion to this. By allowing a sort of mass, phi-dependent mass term. So my equation of motion for my fermion, if I were to ask, is there a non-trivial solution to psi? You might think, oh, well, the lowest energy solution to psi is surely just psi equals zero. So if I look at my Dirac equation, I get something dependent on my profile. And I find that if I have a chiral psi naught prefactor, the lowest energy solution is actually non-trivial. So I can also take my psi naught to depend on x if x obeys the massless Dirac equation. So what this tells me is I have localized chiral fermions on my domain wall. So it's not really saying you can get a standard model localized on one of these objects, but it's simply motivating the fact that you can get things that look like localized gauge fields, spinner fields, etc., living on one of these defects. So this really is just, it's a toy model, but it's an illustration of the sort of modern ideas about different ways of using extra dimensions. So here it illustrates it's illustrating warped extra dimensions. Hierarchy. And also localization. So typically now when people do compactifications, it's not just simple Kaluza-Klein theory. It's usually a bit of a mix and match of different aspects. There's often some sort of warped part of the geometry. There's often aspects of localization. Because there is warping, there's often a sense of a hierarchy, although not possibly the full hierarchy between gravity and standard model physics. But this is really much more of a modern perspective on compactification and modern Kaluza-Klein theory.